From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, actor Harry Lennox joins us to talk about Hollywood diversity and his role in the new film, Batman vs. Superman, Dawn of Justice. But first, the 2016 presidential primary campaigns have been particularly contentious, but it's hardly the first time we've seen negative rhetoric in the race for the White House. Former Democratic presidential nominee Michael Dukakis can speak firsthand on that subject. He joins us with his assessment of this year's presidential race. I almost said wacky presidential race. What word would you put?
Unusual.
In? Unusual. Okay.
That's and, why. And a little wacky.
Yeah. So I don't even know where to begin. I don't want to color the first question too much. So what do you make of this?
Look, a lot of things have been happening politically in this country, especially on the Republican side. And I'm not going to say this is the logical culmination of what's been going on in the Republican side, but there's no question that what we've been seeing on that side of the field has contributed to this.
Yeah.
And not only that, but I don't understand, what's McConnell doing? I mean, at a time when they've got this food fight going on, which I guess is going to go on for some time, he comes in and says, under no circumstances are we going to consider the president's nominee of the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
And that nominee happens to be an extremely able guy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how do you do this?
Mm.
Now, what does it mean for the Democrats? This is a huge opportunity, not just to win the presidency, but to take the Congress back, to really transform the politics of this country. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that I'm going to be doing everything I can to help on is to make sure this is not a slice-and-dice campaign. 50 states, 200,000 precincts, no fooling around. Because this could be a transformative election.
Yeah.
And speaking as a Democrat, we better not blow it. I mean, this is an opportunity not to be missed.
Yeah. So you said a lot there, and I'm glad we got time to unpack this. So let me take them one piece at a time if I can. In no particular order, to your mind, you've been at this a long time, to your mind, what allowed, what contributed, what did Republicans do or not do that made the ground so fertile in this year for a Trump-type candidacy? How did this happen?
I think it's the politics of anger, if I can use that term.
Yeah, sure.
I think it's stoking the worst instincts in people. And don't get me wrong. I'm not suggesting that folks that are supportive of Trump are somehow off or whatever. I mean, I understand what's going on out there. I think we all do. We've got a relatively small number of people at the top who are doing extremely well. And we've got about 80% of the American people who really aren't seeing much improvement in their lives and are pretty angry about it. So that I understand. But you stoke the worst instincts in people.
Mm-hmm.
You run campaigns of anger. It's the only way I can describe them.
Yeah.
Don't be surprised if somebody like Trump comes along, who, by the way, is kind of an interesting character in many ways, doesn't sing at the Republican hymnal. I mean, he's different. Occasionally he surprises you with things that he says, which I think Democrats might agree with. And yet at the same time is benefiting tremendously from this angry stuff that we've been seeing on the Republican side.
But anger is nothing necessarily new. It certainly ebbs and flows in the American electorate. And there is anger from time to time on both sides of the political aisle, as you well know. I guess what I'm asking is, even when the electorate's been angry, that doesn't necessarily, to my mind, mean that you see the success, if I have to call it that, of a candidate who is racist and sexist and xenophobic. I mean, what allows for that kind of person to do this well, where the Republican Party now has to stay up all hours of the night trying to figure out how to stop him?
Well, remember, he's running from one party only. That's a relatively small percentage of the total electorate.
Mm-hmm. I take that.
If you're getting 30-35% of the Republican vote, you're getting, what, maybe 15-20% of the national vote.
Okay.
And too bad, but we've got people who still are into the race thing, still angry about the fact that opportunity for women and for lots of other marginalized people seem to be greater these days. I think that happens to be a strength of what's been happening. Look, I grew up I was in a country that was racist, that was anti-Semitic. I lived in a town just west of Boston where people of color couldn't live in the town. I mean, in liberal Massachusetts. I mean, that's the America I grew up in. It's a very different America. I think a much better America in many respects. But some people really don't believe that. So you still have folks out there that have those kinds of feelings. And at the same time, general discontent with their lot. You can understand why. You put it all together and a guy like Trump comes along and attracts a lot of these folks. Now, what happens to him in a final election? Well, we'll see.
Yeah. Give me your assessment. The audience has heard mine on a variety of occasions on this program and beyond. What's your assessment of the way the media has treated, not treated, covered, not covered? Don't want to frame your answer, but just give me your sense of the media's relationship and its coverage of Donald Trump.
Well, they're obviously into him.
He attracts them. Yeah.
Because of what he says. Mm-hmm. Frankly, I think he's running against a relatively weak field. Mm-hmm. I mean, Cruz is worse. So it's not as if there's great Republican competition out there. And I think the media these days somehow is attracted to this kind of stuff. They love a fight. Mm-hmm. And he gives you a fight. I mean, the other day he took a whack at Elizabeth Warren. I mean, how can you whack Elizabeth Warren? Mm-hmm. I mean, she's one of the nicest, most decent people I know. And I think a really impressive member of the United States Senate. But he's a whacker. Well, so my newspapers in the Boston area today are loaded with the fact that Trump took a shot at Elizabeth Warren. Well, I guess that's newsworthy. Mm-hmm. And covering the fight is always something that the press wants to do. Now, once we get two nominees, then I think you'll see the press not moving away from some of the stuff that Trump talks about, but at least beginning to give us the kind of coverage that we ought to get.
To your point, then, do you think the press has pressed him in this campaign the way that they ought?
Well, he's a tough guy to press. Yeah. You know, he's knocking somebody every day. Mm-hmm. And I suppose to some extent you have to cover that. But I think once we get a couple of nominees, then I think you're going to see the press spending a lot more time.
How much trouble is Donald Trump going to be in? And the Democrats, my sense is they're salivating for this. But there is going to come a moment where he's going to have to release those tax returns. I don't see how you go from here to the White House without being forced to do that. How much trouble do you sense he's in when that chest box gets opened?
Look, I think he's in big trouble generally, providing my party runs the kind of campaign that, to some extent, we haven't.
Right.
And I mean a 50-state campaign. No more slice and dice and red and blue and purple and all that kind of nonsense. Every state, 200,000 precincts, every one with a precinct cabinet and six block cabinets. I'm serious about this. Because that's the way we're going to take advantage of this situation and make this a really transformative election.
And yet the polls, if you believe polls, say that Hillary Clinton is in trouble with guys like you, that is to say white males, not you as a Democrat, of course, but she's struggling even still with white males. So you can have a 50-state strategy precinct by precinct, but if you're not polling well with white males who make up a sizable piece of the electorate, what does she do?
But you organize at the grassroots to connect with those folks. Because they are angry. And they have a right to be angry. Mm-hmm. But lots of white males who happen to be Democrats have got to be out there knocking on those doors and saying, hey, look, this guy's nobody's going to do anything for us. Mm-hmm. You know, Hillary's the person. She's the one that's going to do that. And those are the kind of campaigns that win. And frankly, it was one of the big mistakes I made in 1988 was spending too much time talking to people who I thought knew more than I did about how to run for the presidency, all of whom poo-pooed this idea of precinct-based grassroots organizing for the presidency, right? Mm-hmm. It took Barack Obama not once but twice to prove beyond any doubt that precinct-based grassroots organizing wins the presidency. And I hope we've learned that lesson.
Yeah. When you say that white males have a right to be angry, I guess you have a right to be happy or sad. It's your choice. You have agency to control whatever emotion or express whatever emotion you want. So they have a right to be angry, but what do they have to be angry about in America, white males?
Their real incomes have gone down mm-hmm. over the course of the past 25 years.
They ain't the only ones.
They aren't the only ones, but they have been much more affected by that in many ways than women. You know, we know that women are paid less than men still. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of younger women now that really have economic opportunities they never had before. But generally speaking, working American white males have not made progress. Their standard of living has not gone up. They're working harder for less than they were 20, 25 years ago. And that obviously is going to produce some pretty angry reactions, and they have a right to be that.
Now, but relative to the economic condition of the rest of society, not talking about that 1%, but relative to the rest of society, why are they more angry than anybody else? They've not been hit harder than any other sector of society.
Well,
You want to put the numbers up about black males? You want to put the numbers up about immigrants? I think I take your point, but I'm just trying to understand it.
We've always had this assumption in this country that every generation would do better than the last generation.
Exactly.
And there have certainly been exceptions to that, mm-hmm. right, among minorities and others. But by and large, in a general way, that's been the case. Mm-hmm. This is really the first generation where, in this case, white guys, as a group, have not enjoyed that kind of success. And in point of fact, lots and lots, as we both know, of good, well-paying blue-collar jobs have been disappearing.
Yeah.
Some of that has to do with the general economy. Some of it has to do with trade and so on and so forth. So those are the folks who I think feel it the most because their expectation was, like every other generation, they were going to do better. And they are not doing better.
I'll move on. I don't know that I agree with you respectfully that they feel it the most. I don't know that they feel it any worse than other segments of our society. But for whatever reason, we do agree, and we agree on this, but we don't celebrate this. For whatever reason, they are turning to a candidate who is racist and or certainly racial and xenophobic and sexist, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't know. I guess what I'm getting at is how it is in your mind that group of working class white males who are not doing as well as they want to do or thought they would do economically, how then does a reckless billionaire end up becoming their candidate?
Well, I'm not sure he's going to be their candidate when it's all over.
Well, he's their choice right now. That's what I mean by their candidate.
Choice of some of them, obviously.
Right.
A lot of them are bothered by a lot of the stuff. I've seen some interviews of some of these folks who say, well, you know, he's talking to me about certain stuff, but I don't like this anti-Mexican thing.
Yeah,
I don't know where he's coming from here. You know, I come from an immigrant background and that kind of stuff. But it's the sense of expectation that these folks have had traditionally. You know, it's the American dream, right? You do better than your parents and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
That's the thing that's bothering them. Now, can we change that? Yeah. But we've got to talk with these folks. And frankly, I'm not sure my party has really been talking to them. Let me give you an example.
Please.
Okay. The Affordable Care Act. 80 to 85% of the uninsured people in this country are working or members of working families.
Mm-hmm.
They're not loafing. They're not sitting around. They're not on welfare. If you're on public assistance, you get Medi-Cal or Medicaid, right? These are working Americans. Nobody has said that. Nobody on the Democratic side has said, look, we're talking about working Americans and their families who don't have health care. Now, that kind of appeal, it seems to me, will connect with these folks.
Mm-hmm.
And we just haven't been saying that. Don't ask me why.
Yeah.
You know, we're out trying to help all kinds of groups. But this is all about working Americans. And I suspect that if you ask most Americans, who are the uninsured?
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to tell you that 80 to 85% of them are working.
Well, then why then, to your mind, is there such vitriol, such hatred, such anger and angst about the Affordable Care Act from the other side?
Because I think the Democrats have done a lousy job of helping them to understand who we're talking about.
Right.
If you go out and take a poll tomorrow and say to the American people, should working Americans and their families have decent, affordable health care? 93% say yes.
Sure.
But we haven't been saying that.
Yeah.
This is about working folks. overwhelmingly. And I don't think most Americans know this.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I put a universal health care bill through my legislature mm-hmm. many, many years ago, as yep. you know. And I must have done 200 press events on that bill. I never did one without having a working person or a working family next to me talking about what it's like to try to live without decent health care.
Yeah.
And I just think in this case, I thought the president's leadership was very impressive. And so I think our message didn't say what it should have said. And we didn't connect with these folks.
Yeah. Is Hillary Clinton the presumptive Democratic nominee?
I think so.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I have a lot of respect for Senator Sanders.
Yeah.
Even if he endorsed Jesse Jackson for the presidency in 1988.
I thought you might get to that. has Bernie Sanders made her a better candidate? Has he been good for her?
The answer to that question is absolutely yes.
Yeah.
Because competition, serious competition, always makes you a better candidate.
Yeah.
And if she had just kind of floated through this thing mm-hmm. as the presumptive nominee from mm-hmm. the beginning, I don't think she'd be anywhere near. I think she's very impressive candidate mm-hmm. these days. She's a lot better than she was in 2008, don't mm-hmm. you think?
I totally agree.
I mean, it's no comparison.
Yeah. Better than she was 6 months ago.
And it's all about Bernie being a strong competitor mm-hmm. and forcing her and the people who are campaigning for her, working for her, to really work at it. And I think she's a much improved candidate. I mean, I've always liked her, and we've known her and her husband, you know, since we were both young governors. But I think she's a better candidate. She's going to be a better candidate.
Yeah.
And I think Senator Sanders has a lot to do with that.
To your point, you raised Jesse Jackson's name a moment ago. There's a serious question I want to ask you about that. We believe, at least, we are told that, you know, that there's going to be a contested convention on the Republican side.
Right.
If Hillary Clinton is the presumptive Democratic nominee, maybe not so much at the Democratic convention. Hillary will sail through, essentially. But you've been through this before with Jesse Jackson in 88, as you referenced. What happens to all those Bernie supporters? You know, in the last few months, he's outraised her. I just saw the numbers the other day. Last month, she raised like $30 million. He raised like $45
million. And I wonder how many individual contributors he had.
Oh, yeah, exactly. I mean, he smashed through Obama's record of small donors.
Right.
I mean, he set a record. He just smashed through Obama, not even close.
Right.
So that he's got a lot of people who obviously been behind him. And, at the moment, it appears he may not win this thing. But what happens to all those Bernie supporters at the convention and beyond?
She knows this. She's got to reach out to these folks.
Yeah.
All of us who have been supporting her have got to reach out to them.
Sure.
And in this case, and I'm not suggesting that the argument to them ought to be that this guy, Trump, is so terrible that you can't. It's got to be much more positive than that. Mm-hmm. And we've got to seek to involve these folks in this 200,000 precinct campaign as precinct captains right out there and bring them in, because they're going to be a very important part of what I hope will be a victory, and a very important part of what I hope is going to be a successful administration. But you do it right away. You don't, you know. And sure, there's been some interesting back and forth, but by and large, these are two candidates that I think respect each other and have behaved pretty well in the course of this, in contrast to what's been going on the other side. But you've always got to bear in mind that, you know, that's just the first contest.
Yeah.
It's the last one that is the important one.
This question really is unfair because there have been so many of these debates this time around on the Republican side, certainly, and even the Democrat, even though the number was initially going to be one thing, obviously that number ballooned, which I think has been good for Hillary as well, being more debates.
No question.
But just since you have been on this debate stage before, this time around, 2016, has the American public benefited from these debates? Are these debates still worth anything? Do they have any value? What's your sense of the way we do debate on the presidential stage?
It's mixed.
Yeah.
I prefer, and of course we're not in a position to get to that, but I prefer a debate in which you have a live audience with a moderator. And good people raising the questions, not the press. Nothing against the press. Two of my family are professional journalists, so I've got to be pretty careful. but I remember the Clinton-Bush, What's the matter with me? I'm blanking. The little guy from Texas.
Ross Perot.
Ross Perot.
The little guy from Texas.
Who, by the way, played an important role in that.
Yeah, but that, remember that line, that giant sucking sound down south?
Right. Yeah, I mean, okay. Right. Any event. Yeah. And you remember, it was a single moderator. She happened to be very good and a real pro. And then this live audience of 200 people, carefully selected because they had not made up their minds. I thought it was by far the best presidential debate I'd ever seen.
There could be, depending on how this, you know, there are so many scenarios. But if they seek to deny Trump the nomination at the convention, there are already people writing pieces now that he may violate his agreement. He's even said, he tweeted this, that, you know, I made that pledge before you guys started coming after me. So if you try to deny me the nomination, I may just run as an independent. What happens if we have three people running this time around?
Well, if it's that kind of scenario,
yeah.
then I think it has to benefit the Democrat. I mean, if this splits the Republicans. And frankly, Tavis, I don't know how you deny somebody the nomination who's within 50 or 100 votes of winning.
Yeah.
I mean, I just don't think you can do that.
Yeah.
I mean, putting to one side his talk about riots and so on and so forth, I mean, the fact of the matter is that it's extremely difficult to do that, and you do it at your peril.
Yeah.
Because they're really going to have a wild time.
Well, you endorse, you get behind him and you endorse him at your peril. But it also seems to me that there's peril on the other side, which is that this is the guy saying these kinds of things. The same guy. I mean, I'm gobsmacked. I mean, I'm not. Maybe gobsmacked's too strong a word because I know politics is a funky business anyway. But it gobsmacks me when I see Chris Christie and just run the list. People who have said all these things about Donald in the past. And then they just do a complete 180 and come. I mean, and so my point is that there are a lot of Republicans who are going to have to swallow really hard. So there's peril in supporting the guy, but there's not supporting him. But there's also peril, it seems to me, in supporting a guy who you have previously said is like the devil incarnate.
Well, that's a dilemma those folks are going to have to face. Not only that, I think there are going to be a lot of states in play. I mean, I just saw a poll from Utah. It says that if he's the nominee, Hillary wins. Now, it's just a poll.
Sure.
But it does.
He puts a lot of states in play. I see your point.
Let me tell you. That gives the Democrats an opportunity to really go out and do some serious work in states that have been kind
of. So here's a question for you. And you intimated this earlier, so I want to go right at it. So we've seen, you've been at this longer than I've been at it. We've seen a lot of scenarios where Democrats should have had one result. And they kind of defeated themselves.
One of them was in 1988.
We won't talk about that. But how could Democrats blow this thing? The table is so set, it would seem. How could they blow this?
Because politics is a funny business.
Yeah.
And very unpredictable. And that's one of the reasons why we have to take this very seriously from the beginning. No chortling around about the fact that we've got this kind of food fight going on the other side. And I am serious. A precinct captain and six block captains in every single one of the 200,000 precincts in the United States, in every one of the 50 states. That's what we've got to do. We're going to win and win big.
Last question. I've moved right past this, and so have you for that matter, because we just assume that it's possible. But whether it's Trump or somebody else on the other side, Hillary Clinton is still a woman. Is America ready for a woman president?
Yes. It's got to be good.
Yeah.
And we've got a very good candidate, but sure, we're ready.
Okay. Governor, always good to have you on.
A pleasure.
Thanks for your insights, my friend.
Okay.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Harry Lennix is a familiar face on TV and in the movies. He's a featured player on NBC's hit drama, The Blacklist, and this weekend he reprises his role as General Swanwick in Batman versus Superman, Dawn of Justice. He's also a tireless advocate for diversity in Hollywood and always a welcome guest on this program. You know, you are diversity in Hollywood. Good to see you, man.
Great to see you, Tavis.
You been all right?
I've been, well, busy.
Yeah, been busy, yeah.
Was at the premiere for Batman versus Superman. We had a great time.
Yeah.
Everybody showed up.
Yeah. Did you like it?
I did. I have to tell you, I was.
You hadn't seen anything.
I did a little bit of ADR, a little voiceover work on it.
Right.
But I had only seen it in snippets. But I have to tell you, I'm convinced that it's going to blow the charts off.
Yeah. Blockbuster.
I think so.
Yeah, yeah,
of course,
yeah.
You don't want to jinx these kinds of things.
Yeah.
But I would say if quality matters in these kinds of tentpole projects, that this is a good sign.
Speaking of tentpole projects, how do you make your choices? Because you're a uniquely different kind of brother, and we'll talk about that and the way you see the world and the choices that you make. But how does Harry Lennox go about making the choices that he makes? Because one day you're in a blockbuster like Batman vs. Superman or the movie Ray or Five Heartbeats. You're in these blockbuster kind of projects. Then you'll do these independent things, including your own independent work. So how do you go about making choices about what makes sense for you to do or not do?
A lot of it comes down to availability and opportunity and people who are interested in the kind of work that I do.
Yeah.
But I would say that you never really know if something's going to be a blockbuster. You might have a pretty good idea, if it's The Matrix 2 or 3, which I was lucky enough to do.
I could have said that and I didn't, but go ahead. Yeah.
Oh, that's all right. Yeah, that's quite all right. But you have a pretty good idea that people are going to be interested in it. And we have a pretty good idea that people are going to be interested in Batman and Superman.
Yeah.
But normally it comes down to if there's a script that is out there, it's really on the page.
Right.
And it's really the quality of the work that I think is the final determination for me.
Yeah.
If it's something that I think is interesting, even if I'm not all up in it, it'll be something that I'll be willing to participate in.
Yeah.
And if it's something that is off the beaten track, that'll show a different side to a story that is otherwise not going to be seen, then it's something that I'm likely to take a second look at.
Yeah. As you look back on The Matrix, you were in, as you mentioned, 2 and 3, and our friend Cornel West was in one of those things.
Yes.
I remember the scene, yeah. When you look back on that, on those two movies, why do you think they so resonated? That was such a huge trilogy.
Well, I think the science behind it, really, it's more than the science behind The Matrix. It's the philosophy of it. Cornell actually wound up doing a kind of companion piece to The Matrix movies called The Philosophy of The Matrix, I think it was called, or it might have been called Through the Wormhole. I can't remember exactly what it was called, but it was really a bunch of top-notch philosophers talking about what the ideas behind The Matrix were.
Mm-hmm.
So when we think about things like what is intelligence, what is artificial intelligence, how will that manifest itself in the future?
Yeah.
We really don't know. We're at a time now when maybe in 20 or 30 years as the expanse of intelligence and as the rate at which these things are accelerating, we'll be able to really do a la carte human experience.
Mm-hmm.
We got these glasses now or whatever. I think Samsung's coming out with these virtual reality glasses. But if you think about the idea that sort of prompted The Matrix, it was a Charles Baudrillard philosophical treatise called Simulation and Simulacra.
Mm-hmm.
And it was that at some point, somebody will be able to create a map which will fit exactly over a landscape and will be so real that you won't be able to tell the difference between the virtual reality and the reality.
Okay.
So now you've got hyper-real versus real, where people are really expressing a preference for the simulated thing, for the virtual reality over the reality. And I think that that's increasingly happening in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got now gender assignment things happening. You're going to probably be able to pick eye color. You may eventually be able to pick race. So I think that as humans advance, we will be outstripped by the advance in technology. And so we're going to have to really figure out what it is that we want to experience as a human experience. So I think that's going to be endlessly fascinating. I think if you release The Matrix today, it would be as influential as it was however many years ago that it came out.
Let me get all up in your Kool-Aid, all up in your business just for a second here. Because based on what you've just said, I know you to be a man of faith as well. Based on what you've just said, how does that challenge your faith, your Christology? How do you juxtapose those two things, what we will be able to do and what God, the Creator, has intended?
It's a very excellent question and something that that I've sort of nibbled around. Mm-hmm. I haven't really put it in that way, which is why you're you, which I enjoy talking to you so much. But I think that, when it comes to the idea behind God, theology in itself.
You went to seminary at one point years ago.
I did.
As I recall. Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
I did.
I asked the right question here of the right person.
Yeah. And I really enjoy reading the works of philosophers and theologians, particularly Paul Tillich and people of this nature who describe in their mind, or even somebody like Aquinas, who I regard as the greatest of all of the sort of Christian philosophers.
Sure.
I think that God, in some sense, has evolved along with us, or our conception of him or it has evolved with us. I think that God is so big that we can't possibly conceive all of what it is and all of the perspectives on that. So I think that really it is we who have evolved. Mm-hmm. But when you get down to sacred writing and when you get down to scriptural writing and understanding of what his message is for us and in our present, I think that it has to evolve. So I think last time we talked, I may have mentioned that, you know, when the prophet Muhammad came along, he said, or he described God in such a way that was for that specific group of people at that specific time. When the Honorable Elijah Muhammad came along, who gave to black people at that time in 1930 when the Nation of Islam was sort of getting its feet under it, what is God? Who is God? How do we describe him? Is he a man? Is he like us? And even if you look at the Bible, you know, God wrestles with people from time to time. He walks with people from time to time. He can appear in many different ways. But it is. But I think that the real question for me is, how is God personally revealing? And I think that that really ultimately is where it gets down to. God for me has to be somebody who is like me, or I am somebody who is like God, and that I have to be able to find myself in him at all times and to be able to find him in me. And I think once we get to the place, and I think a lot of us, and when I say us, I'm talking right now about black people in America, that we go so far outside of ourselves to find God, somebody that does not look like us, somebody that does not have our best interests at heart, that we're trying to appease something that we can never appease because it is antithetical to our nature. So for me, it has to be something that is harmonious with what is in our life, in the world, in nature, and I think if we can get into harmony with that, always trying to ascend to a higher vibration, if you will, then I think that we'll be in union with that God.
You mentioned the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, which made my mind immediately go to your hometown of Chicago. And I think the last time I actually saw you in person, we were in Chicago. We ran at each other and ended up having some breaking some bread together.
That's right. That's what we did.
Had dinner together. I was leaving town, and you were just arriving town to start filming Chirac, the Spike Lee film. So it was great. So that's the last time I saw you in person, I think. So it's been great conversation and controversy around the film. The film was done. It came out, and people had their own reactions to it. What's your post-mortem now on that project?
I think the Spike made one of his best movies in many, many years. I think that is something that we've all that we were all proud of. My good friend John Cusack, who's also from Chicago. I didn't get a chance to work with Sam and some of the other people, but I did with Angela Bassett and a bunch of other people. We were proud of what we were doing when we were doing it, trying to stem the tide of violence there. And this is, again, goes, I think it speaks directly to what I'm talking about. When you can look at somebody in your neighborhood, a neighbor, a friend, a brother, and see something or somebody that is not worthy of life, and that you can just rather whimsically dismiss of just with a gunshot, not thinking about what the impact of that is, then that's a horrible circumstance. And that means that we are people who are not in union with our God. And so I think that Spike, even though he faced a lot of controversy because of the title of the movie, that's really what the crux of the matter was.
And Rahm Emanuel, the mayor of the city, kind of led that fight.
Rahm Emanuel led the fight, and we now see where the city is with regard to the mayor. He's one of the most unpopular mayors, I think, in America right now. Maybe Snyder, who's
Michigan,
the governor of Michigan, might be competing with him. But, you know, a rose by another name, as it says in Shakespeare, would smell as sweet, and garbage would smell as bad. And I'm not saying that about any person, but I'm saying about the circumstances in Chicago. There are fewer resources in Chicago in the poor neighborhoods that desperately need them than there are in the richer, most well-endowed neighborhoods. Schools are closing. These kinds of things are happening in Chicago. They're happening all over the world. My sister was affected by it. She was a principal. She closed the school down for no particularly good reason. So you're now having, people are now having to go outside of their neighborhoods, outside of their communities, further deteriorating the quality of life they're in. And they're finding themselves really with not a lot of advocacy. And I think that that's a crime.
Yeah.
And I think, and honestly, you know, I see a lot of this Black Lives Matter and all of these things with people saying important and valuable things. But I see a lot of that being projected now on people who are running for office. Mm-hmm. But I do not see the same kind of accountability for the people who are currently in office. And I mean that should go all the way up to the White House. Mm-hmm. It should go to the Attorney General of the United States. Why are we not telling them what is important in the Black community? They're the ones who can right now, not talking about 8 months from now or 10 months from now or 5 years from now or 20 years ago, right now, those are the people who need to be hearing these lessons. And I think that Rahm Emanuel, who had an issue with the title of Chirac, really should start dealing with what is the subject matter of it, which is that when you take away resources, when you take away opportunities from neighborhoods, which is Chicago calls itself a city of neighborhoods, you're going to get these results. I don't think there's anything surprising about it at all.
Let me follow you in. I love following where you lead. Where you lead, I will follow, Harry Licks. So let me follow you. There are two things I want to ask you about specifically, since you've called them both by name. And I'm on record clearly with my feelings about this, but this is your conversation. So I want to, I'm curious. Given that cover-up, that's the only word I can think of, that just untenable, unacceptable, unbelievable cover-up in the Chicago Police Department that Mayor Emanuel was aware of, should he be dismissed from office? Why is he still in office?
I think there's a couple of, you know, those kinds of questions have real answers to them. And I think one of the reasons that he's still in office is because people voted for him. And they voted for him because he was endorsed by certain people and he made certain promises to certain people, some of whom are my friends and that I have great regard for. And he made these promises with the belief that in some way the situation was going to get better. But the situation has not gotten better. And since that election in March of last year, that's when the Laquan McDonald thing happened. Mm-hmm. It already occurred.
Yeah.
But the fact it became the facts
tape.
Became
yeah, sure.
revealed
sure, sure.
thereafter.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, so to me, that's a gross misrepresentation of the truth.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lie. It is a cover-up. And I believe that that is worthy of the strictest penalty. And if I were he, I would resign. And I think that there are people who are capable, who can fulfill the role of the mayor. So, look, I don't vote in Chicago anymore, so I have very little to say about it. But my family still lives there. My friends still live there. And I have to tell you, I think that there, if all up and down the political spectrum in Chicago, heads should roll. And it's not a race-based thing. It's people who knew what was going on, who deliberately covered it up.
Since you raised his name, in the middle of this controversy about this cover-up in the Chicago Police Department, Barack Obama, President Obama, goes back to Chicago, as he does from time to time, and on one of those trips made it abundantly clear how he felt about Rahm Emanuel. He said, I still stand by him. No surprise, he campaigned for him twice when he ran for mayor. Then he comes to town in the midst of all this drama and still says, I support Rahm Emanuel. As you well know, being from there, a whole lot of black folk went crazy in Chicago when Barack Obama made that statement, still standing behind his guy, Rahm Emanuel. But since you raised his name earlier in this conversation, we're near the end now. We're nearing the end. You knew Barack Obama before anybody else knew him in Chicago. You guys were friends and hung out. And there are a lot of people who watch his mannerisms at times and the way he presents himself and know that he learned. I won't say learned. I don't want to disrespect the president, but that things rub off on you when you hang with people who are actors and et cetera, et cetera. So your style, your approach, people have made that comparison. I'm not the first one to say that. But I guess the question is, given your friendship that started so many years ago in Chicago, as we near the end of his two terms, what's your assessment of how your friend has done?
Well, I think that in all honesty, I thought that there would be a lot more controversy, a lot more pushback against the president from the Congress and so forth. And I know a lot of people lay the blame at the feet of Congress. But I like to remind people that he had a supermajority in both houses of Congress when he got into office. And he took that power and he took that mandate, if you will, and squandered it on something which I think is a feeble health care bill when we have far more urgent issues to deal with. I think that there were promises made that were not kept. Stuff dealing with civil liberties. The Patriot Act was doubled down on. Mm-hmm. The bank bailouts happened. We're hearing Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton talk about mm-hmm. these things now. Prison sentencing reform, nothing has moved on that. So all of the disparities and the people making complaints now about the three strikes you're out thing that President Clinton, at the time he was in office, signed into law, there are things that could have fixed that, ameliorated that. And I think that I can almost look at every other demographic or special interest and find something that was gained in the last 7 years or so. But I can find nothing that was gained on behalf of the black people. And so I'm just as a constituent and as a person whose primary interest is in the amelioration of the condition of our people, I'm disappointed. But I understand it's a difficult task and that he has to be the president for everybody. And so taking that into account, I guess my grade would be a C minus. But I would have to say it could have been a lot better. And I think that there was an opportunity here that was missed. I think that a lot of white people voted for the president mm-hmm. And wanted to see something done, and nothing was done. And I would rather that had been done, because I don't think there's going to be anybody coming anytime soon into that office that's going to be able to address these issues that really has the kind of power of the body politic behind it. Now, when I listen to Secretary Clinton and to Senator Sanders speak, I hear things that I like. And so I'm hoping that in the very near future mm-hmm. that we'll be able to really get some progress.
There are some who've suggested that if Hillary Clinton is the presumptive Democratic nominee, there's some who suggested that if she is elected, that she would actually will, some believe, get more done for our people because she won't be boxed in by race in the way that either he was or chose to be.
I would agree with that. Yeah. I would certainly hope that that's the case. I was a surrogate for the secretary mm-hmm. in 2008. I would be happy to serve in that function again. But I think more than waiting for anyone, politician,
sure.
To do anything on our behalf, specifically in these matters, I think that we really have to start taking the ball into our own hands, the matters into our own hands.
I also have not seen you since we had the Oscars So White controversy this year, but I was anxious to talk to you and to get to you. I said, I wonder what my friend Harry Lennox, of all the people's opinion, I had a number of folk asking my opinions, and I wrote an op-ed about it and did some stuff for CBS about it, but I really wanted to know what Harry Lennox thought about it. So here's my chance now with 5 minutes to go to get your take on the year that was or wasn't at the Academy Awards and this issue writ large. We've just seen over the last few days the Academy president, Cheryl Boone Isaacs, come out and make an announcement that there are some new people now who are on the Board of Governors. They came out a few days ago and made an announcement. They're trying to change things. But what's your sense of this morass of...
Right, we're the state of the art, as it were.
Yeah.
I think a lot of those moves are good.
Yeah.
I applaud them. I think that anytime we could talk about inclusion and sharing power, that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
I do not, however, believe that the window dressing in and of itself is going to change much. My issue with the Oscars being so white is when black people are nominated for things and when they win certain awards, whether it's the Academy Awards or the NAACP Awards, that it's very troublesome what they win for.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the subjects that we are ourselves putting our resources in, making movies about, making television content about, are troubling. We continuously go back to the past mm-hmm. to deal with these issues. When we have issues today that are not being addressed. And that's one of the reasons that I applaud Spike and Chirac for Chirac mm-hmm. and for doing that, and a couple of other people. Creed, I think, mm-hmm. movies that are being made about an empowered group of people or fully realized modern circumstances that they're dealing with.
In real time, yeah.
In real time.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think that the Oscars, it didn't surprise me. I don't watch the Oscars anyway, so, I mean, I can't boycott something that I didn't pay much attention to in the first week because I don't think that awards are the point.
Yeah.
I think that the point is that this is today. Movies, television, internet, communications of a whole. If you look at the number of tickets sold in America in 2014 or 2015, some billion tickets or so, almost half of those are going to be bought by black people. And what they are consuming is not nutritious for them. And so what I would rather see, rather than worry about the awards that people are getting and for what they're getting them for, they should really start looking at the content. And I've said for a little while now that we get to see ourselves downtrodden more than we are represented in the population. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that that's really the point. So it seems to me like a lot of that stuff is for insiders, an elite group of people who get together and congratulate themselves every year. That's fine. I don't have a problem with that. They have a right to do that and to make the movies that they want to make and so forth. But I would rather we switch the conversation to something far more relevant.
So as an actor who has the capacity, the power, the ability, and the platform for your own independent company to do something about that, what do you do?
Well, I think one of the things that we really have to look at is what we are consuming. And I think the other thing is how we get that out, where we put those things and who puts them out there. So distribution is hugely important. Very little black distribution. I don't know what it is for Latinos and for Asians and so forth. Of course, they have Bollywood and all these other kinds of things. But I don't know really what's going on with regard to distribution for black people. We still have to go to other groups of people to see if they like what it is that we're doing. Mm-hmm. So I think that the real issue is to try to fix the machinery behind the content, and then also to fix the content at the same time. For me, I think that I want to be a company that creates classics. Mm-hmm. I want to be a manufacturer of classic fare and content. And I think that that's not an easy reach. We have great literature. Some of the greatest literature in American history is written by black authors. Mm-hmm. Some of the greatest scholarship is being done by black writers and black scholars. Some of the greatest music. Some of the greatest dance. All of these things should be celebrated throughout the world. And I intend to use my platform, if such a thing should exist, to come into being for that purpose.
Yeah. 30 seconds to go. I close by going back to where we started, Batman versus Superman. Can you tell me anything without getting yourself in trouble about John Swanwick?
I can't tell you a whole lot about Swanwick, but I can tell you there's a woman in it who is a wonder. And I think I'm not alone in
that. On that note, but I'm out of here. Harry, good to have you on the program, man.
Great to be back.
You can see Harry Lennox anywhere. Batman versus Superman this weekend, The Blacklist, everywhere. He's doing a little bit of everything, and I'm always glad to have you back on our program. You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Tony Marcano is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.